WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Just about everybody who's 30 and older grew up with the books of Maurice Sendak. A Hole is to Dig, Where the Wild Things Are, In the Night Kitchen, Higgledy Piggledy Pop are some of his most famous books. His new book, Outside Over There, plays on a fear that I know I certainly had when I was a kid growing up, the fear of being kidnapped. A baby is kidnapped while his sister is playing her horn and gazing out the window. The goblins slip in through another window, take the baby, and replace the poor infant with a baby made of ice. The illustrations in this book are beautiful, set in the early 18th century, very pastoral, but are also very surreal, kind of nightmarish. The goblins in their gray hooded robes look a little bit like an Ingmar Bergman personification of death. Some adults are worried that this book may be a little too scary for the kids, but I'm sure Maurice Sendak will take issue with that, and that's one of the subjects that we'll be discussing. Sendak has been honored with most of the prestigious awards for children's book illustrations, including the Hans Christian Andersen Medal and the Caldecott Medal. During the 70s and 80s, he's been doing some other things as well. His animated film, Really Rosie, starring the Nutshell Kids, was broadcast on CBS in 1975. He created the sets and costumes for the 1980 Houston Opera production of Mozart's The Magic Flute and for Janáček's opera, The Cunning Little Vixens. He's designed sets and costumes for a Brussels opera version of Where the Wild Things Are, for which he also adapted his book for the libretto. Sendak fans in the Delaware Valley will be able to see some of the toys, photos, and illustrations that have inspired his own work in a new show which opens Thursday at the Rosenbach Gallery. Maurice Sendak, the Artist's Collection of Children's Toys, Books, and Drawings is what the show is called. It includes some of his incredible collection of Mickey Mouse items, so you might be interested in seeing that too. And this is at the Rosenbach Museum, 2010 Delancey Place. For more information about that show, you can call 732-1600. His new book, Outside Over There, is published by Harper & Row. Welcome to Fresh Air. It's
Hi, nice
really
to be
great
here.
To meet you. What kind of book attracted you as a kid?
Comic books, mostly, because there were no children's books. I mean, one was not conscious of children's books, specific children's books in the 30s. One wanted to read a book, one wanted to read not a children's book if you were a child, but something more sophisticated. I wanted to read my sister's books, even though I may not have understood a word of them. So what finally filtered down to me would have been the everyday comic book, mostly Mickey Mouse comics, and where the Mickey Mouse obsession began, probably right around then. So I have no recollection of books except what we were forced to hear in school, in the auditorium on Fridays with hands clasped, and so you hate, loathe, and despise the books you heard, even though they turn out to be quite wonderful when you read them again when you're an adult. Mixed feelings about books as a child, as a matter of fact. My favorite was Mickey Mouse and Pygmy Land, which I thought was a classic, but turns out to have been just a rip-off Gulliver's Travels and an insane, bizarre one, but a hilarious book, and I still have it, and it's wonderful graphics.
So did parents or teachers try to wean you away from evil comic books?
No. No one gave a rap, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, that obsession occurred only decades later about the effects of comic books and then later television on children, but they were so happy to have us quiet. We read anything, and they let us read anything because the whole point was to keep kids shut up and quiet, whatever they read or whatever they did, as a matter of fact. So we were free to read whatever we liked. And I was lucky because my siblings, elder brother and sister, were avid readers. So books were finally taken out for me from the library. But happily, books they would have read, not kiddie books. I wouldn't have been caught dead with a kiddie book. As I said earlier, I would have read only real books, long pages with many words on them, whatever the hell they said.
You think for a child today that one of your books would fall into that category of kiddie books or adult books?
No, because I have such a hatred for the specific category of kiddie books, having once been a kiddie and having felt all the humiliation of that role and the condescension from adults, you wanted only what you would achieve or you would learn from or something above and beyond your range, your so-called range. So I have worked very hard in my career not to do books for children with quotes around that. Yes, they are books for children, of course, but they're complicated, serious works, I hope, most of them, in just the way children are complicated and serious little creatures.
Did you read fairy tales?
Yes, I read fairy tales, but not till much later. I didn't come upon Grimm or Andersen until my adolescence, actually. Knew of them, didn't read them.
By that time, you weren't supposed to be reading them.
No, but by that time, I'd gotten over the prejudice that they were books for children or sweet or coy or silly, and found that although I still am not keen on Andersen's fairy tales, I think his are very bland takes on the Grimm, most of them. Of course, there are some superb Andersen, but I think a very small amount of them are original and terrific. But the Grimm are fabulous, wonderful stories, and they should be read by children because they were never intended for children, and those are always the best things for children. The Grimm brothers were appalled originally when the book's stories came out and the kids ate them up. You know, they thought they were scholarly historical tomes, and what were the kids reading them for? But we know now the kids read them because there was nothing else as good around to read.
Now, some people have felt that your work is a little too heavy for kids, particularly the new book, which has some wonderfully surreal and kind of scary images in it, dream nightmare kind of images.
Well, it's disappointing to think that they already feel that, but since I've been through that with everything I've published, I'm a little bit immune to it because it's based on the misconception, an ancient, tedious misconception, that children don't know these things or don't feel these things. And I have a direct link-up with my memory as a child, so I know I did, and I know I was not an unusual child. I was merely a child, and I stand here to record the feelings earnestly and honestly of all children in the world who happen to feel very complicated feelings about life and death and sex and all kinds of things, and books should and have to be serious for them. I don't mean serious solemn. They could be serious funny, which is even better, but they have to be honest to a child's life, which is a very complicated life, as complicated as our lives are, and how dare we assume that they are not, since we become what we were. Hadn't we best treat the kid like a serious subject for a change?
I think that the parents who are afraid of spooky images worry that once a child has seen something, they won't be able to get rid of it, and they'll take it to bed with them at night, and it'll cause nightmares.
In all fairness to parents, I mean, all parents love their children, that is, the good parents, and they want to protect their children. That's a natural thing. And you see something that you think will be frightening, well, your first impulse is to protect your child from this. That is true. And there are books, in fact, that children should be protected from. So you can't generalize too much. However, I'm very careful about what I put in my books. I don't set out to freak children out or to scare them. I'm setting out to do just the opposite, to comfort them. But the only way I know how to comfort them is by telling them the truth, and the truth before you get to the comfort often is scary. But I firmly believe, and there are those who disagree, and that's the way it is, that children know this already. You're not putting it into their heads. They are not seeing it for the first time. In fact, I believe they are recognizing or get comfort from seeing something they thought only they had in their heads. And they're made happy by a book which represents images or fears which they've had for a long time, perhaps unconfessed to the parents or to anybody else, and it is relieved through the work of art that they're looking at. So I don't believe, as most parents do, that the children are seeing this for the first time and being terrified.
Let's look at some of the fears that you really work with in your new book, Outside Over There. Do you want to give us a little capsule of the story that you've created?
Well, first I have to set one thing straight, is that when I did Outside Over There, or when I write or illustrate any of my books, I don't set out to vanquish fears. I mean, I'm not a psychologist. I'm an artist. And I'm working from within myself. I'm not out to help the world of kids. I really am not a sociological banner waver or whatever. But if in working out something for myself as an artist, I happen to work out something for everybody else, okay, that's wonderful. That's sort of a dividend, and actually is a mark that your book is more than just an ego shtick. It means your book means something else besides what it just meant to you. So I don't set out to say, well, what fears do I have which I will now exorcise in this book? Well, you know you have a piece of junk if you think that way. If you approach a work of art that way, it is not a work of art. So you do it in a kind of seizure, in a kind of obsession, in a kind of ferociously happy excitement. You're not aware that you're dealing with a problem. You're aware that you're dealing with words and pictures which immensely turn you on. Otherwise, why the hell would you do it? You're not going to do it because you're grumpy and vile feeling and you're going to solve a problem. I mean, do that in your psychiatrist's office. So it's hard for me to answer that in terms of I don't begin anything like that. I'm so turned on by my subject. I'm so excited by my subject. I don't see it as a problem. I don't see it as a fear. I don't see it as a dream or a surreal nightmare. I see it only as a fantastic subject to involve myself with, to evolve as an artist, to fill my time with, and to make beautiful in the end.
Well,
if
did,
I can.
How did the subject of this book
come about?
Come to you, yeah.
Well, there are two parts to that answer. One is an inner part, which I can't answer because it's unconscious. I don't know. I'm like an antenna. I'm like a typewriter. Something inside dictates, and I'm just the feeble external apparatus that puts it down. But then there are the turn-ons, the real things, like an image of a little girl from childhood that I've been obsessed with. I saw in a picture book. I have no recollection of the book, but I remember the image. Why did it excite me? I couldn't tell you. There's nothing exciting about it as you describe it. Kid in a storm with a big raincoat, rain pouring in her red galoshes, dark gray sky behind. And I wanted to see the picture over and over again, and every time I saw it, I screamed and ran in terror, which tells you how much terror turns you on or pleases you, because I kept going back and back and back. She stayed with me for about 45 years now. I can't tell you why, but I don't really much care. I mean, I accept the fact that she is vivid and that something about her dictates and determines a work of art. You know, I obey. I've always been an obedient person, and I certainly obey my unconscious. So if she was preserved, then I assume she was preserved for a good reason, and that is that. So she had to be, it had to be a book about a little girl in a rain with a big raincoat. Just had to be. There's your subject all determined for you. But what kind of story is that? Well, then I did the Juniper Tree, Grimm's Fairy Tales, and had a wonderful story called The Goblins, about how goblins come and steal your baby away and put a changeling in its place. It's a wonderful, very brief, two-chapter German fairy tale. So succinct and to the point. And the point of it is that how does a mother know? Mother's busy. And behind her back, this occurs. When she turns around, how does she know? Often, normal babies look just as dopey as changelings. They drool and their eyes cross, right? So, but if she is a very critical mother, an observant mother, she will know something's amiss. And what you do, according to the Grimm fairy tales, you break an egg, take the shells, fill them with water, cook them on the stove, and if the baby starts yakking, like, what the hell are you doing? Then you know you've got... Because your own baby would not know what you were doing, nor could care less. But a changeling baby will know you're doing something idiotic. The minute that happens, you know you've been duped. Or if you're musically inclined, you pick up an instrument and play, and the changelings cannot resist dancing. Well, if the baby starts to dance, you certainly know it's yours, who can hardly toddle. Then you knock three times, and the goblins, sulky or whatever, must come and remove this object and return your natural child. I can't tell you why I love that story so much. It's both funny and horrific. And when I illustrated that story, then I knew I had to take that baby and give it to that girl and make up a story about them both. And that was the beginning of Outside Over There, which was many years ago, until I could evolve a sufficient plot to make a book out of it. But I got everything I wanted. I got the changeling. I got the baby that's stolen. I got a girl who puts on a raincoat who goes out in the rain. All those determined unconscious needs were, in fact, gratified. And that's all, as an artist, I have to do.
For me in the story, one of the things that I just really loved was the whole kidnapping thing. And I had no idea of this this whole goblin story that you've been telling. But I really did grow up with the fear of kidnapping. I think a lot of kids did.
I think all children worry about being taken away, or the reverse, that they belong to the wrong parents,
right?
And really belong to Grace Kelly and her husband in Monaco, and are stuck there in Brooklyn. I mean, it's a fantasy most children have, yes, of being taken away or having been taken away. I certainly did. I grew up in the 30s when kidnapping was comme il faut. I mean, it was the thing. It was a way of life. I was very interested in reading Gloria Vanderbilt's book, Little Gloria Happy at Last, because that was a typical 30s, my generation experience of an atmosphere that was electrified with the disappearance of children. And I know I must have grown up feeling and thinking that a lot. And I was very disappointed once when telling how I feared being taken, and my uncle laughed cynically and said, well, why in the world would anybody take you? I mean, you're just a poor Jewish kid. I was so offended because I didn't know that kidnappers were socially oriented or that they really, obviously, I was really hurt. It was all that anxiety about if they weren't ever going to take me.
The illustrations in your new book are so beautiful. I really only regret I didn't have them around to look at when I was younger, because I think I would have really enjoyed it then too, well, which isn't to make short shrift of what it does for me as an adult.
Good. I'm glad you added that.
I hear so much people complaining about television and how kids don't read anymore. And I think of your books and how beautiful the images are and how, when you talk about visual literacy and things, I mean, it seems to me wonderful to have books for children who are young that are so visually rich. Do you think that we don't make enough of visual imagery young people? Don't take it seriously?
I think if you're talking about books, you have to go a step further. And books are words first. And if we have a problem today, perhaps it is that there isn't sufficient, not enough well-written books for children, to put it in simple English, and that I'm not so interested in visually oriented books. I mean, I'm an illustrator by nature, but in writing a book like Outside Over There, I'm more concerned with writing than I am with illustrating. In fact, what I'm saying is that there aren't enough books that are written in the sense that they are meaningfully written, so that you catch a kid and he or she is going to read come hell or high water, but you've got to catch a kid. You've got to catch any audience that you're writing for. You have to be extremely concerned with writing as a craft and as an art. And the visual things spring from the word if you're an illustrator. If you're an illustrator, your first love is words, not pictures, because then you might as well be a painter. But I don't get turned on by canvas. I get turned on by language. And pictures come from language. And then a picture, or rather a book, is important because of what is written in the book. The pictures are secondary. Important, but secondary.
You know, I feel like I know very little about children and what they like and what appeals to them. So, like, when I go out to buy a gift for a friend or a niece, I tend to go with what I like. And usually, like, inevitably, the person in the store who's trying their hardest to show me around and help me out, since I look so lost in there, it convinces me at some point that I'm, like, really projecting what I like, and, like, what the kid likes isn't really going to bear much relationship to my taste at all. And sometimes I think they're right. What's your experience with that?
I'm going to take a moment to raise your consciousness, whatever that expression is right now, because people are so intimidated. Like, they don't know about children's books. They don't know how to buy them, write them, illustrate them, market them, whatever. In fact, there's nothing to it. In fact, there is no way. In fact, when you go and buy a book, you buy a book because you like it. You mustn't let anybody tell you that there's some mythos or some peculiar specialness about it. There isn't. It's nonsense. And if you go and you're describing a very typical adult attitude, which I wish you as a person would get over, and that what you bring to your purchase of a book for a child or anyone else is the only valid thing you have. There is no way of looking at the correct children's book, because there is no such thing as a correct. There's only a good or a bad book. That's all. And no one knows better than you do. No one knows better than your own instinct will ever tell you. And the people who try and write for children make the same mistake. Like, how can I, they tell me or ask me frequently, how do you write for children? And the answer is, you don't. I mean, how in the world do you write for children? You write for yourself. And if you're lucky, it turns out to be something kids want to read. Sometimes they don't want to read it. Kids have as varied and complicated and whimsical tastes as we do. There's no magic to any of this. And if people would get over the fact that there was no magic, they would probably be better writing for kids, because people would just write a book. George MacDonald, Lewis Carroll, Edward Lear, all the greats did not write for children. They wrote out of themselves, and the books turned out to be books children love, the way Grimm's, as I earlier described. The same would be for you, were you to write something. If you were to set out to write a book for a child, you'd be doomed. If you set out to write a book, period, that's all you should be concerned with. Not age bracketing, but being an artist, period.
Talking with Maury Sendak, if you're just joining us. Do you remember any images that really scared you a lot when you were young? You mentioned that one with the raincoat.
Yeah. Well, that was a book image. Movie images scared me a lot. I mean, King Kong scared me a lot, but I love King Kong better than most people I know. There is that combination of sweet terror, you know, something that both frightens and attracts immensely. We all know that as adults, and children enjoy the same. It's a kind of sensuous turn-on. It's a wonderful thing. But then there are the things that just frighten, that have no compensation whatsoever. I remember a film called The Wax Museum that my father took me to see, which gave me the whammies for as far back as I can remember. And worse than that was a movie which, it was The Invisible Man. And The Invisible Man was a movie that really set a series of nightmares in my childhood. It was so obvious that it would, because what could be more terrifying than someone you can't see in the room, but whom you think probably is? Not like having a giant panda in the closet or some cutesy thing like that. Here is a man who, when he unraveled the bandages on his head, there was nothing there. Well, he could be under the bed, he can be on the curtain, as I told my sister complainingly for years when she tried to leave me to go to sleep by myself. I said, he's in the room. And she'd say, no, he wasn't, but how did she know? Now, that was a terrifying experience. And I saw the film much later with Claude Rains. It happens to be a superb film made in the 30s. And as I saw it again, I felt the same hair standing on end reaction. I'd not gotten over it.
So do you think that those frightening images damaged you in any
way?
No,
of course not. I mean, you live every day with damaging images. You think a child gets through the day without being banged and bashed any better than we do? How can you spare a child, or ourselves for that matter, damaging images? If you're alive, what are you going to do? I mean, hide under the bed for the rest of your life. And you probably find something terrifying there, too. So you'd best not worry about it too much.
Is it fair to make any connections between great beast movies like King Kong and Where the Wild Things Are?
Oh, well, sure. I mean, Where the Wild Things is my homage to King Kong. When Max has a ferocious fantasy, he's going to think of the things I think of because I'm Max. And I'm going to think of big, monstrous things, but they're not going to scare me because I am in complete control of them since this is my book. And as a matter of fact, Kong is such an ingenious film that, as terrible and terrifying as he is, we love him at the end. When he falls from the Empire State, it's not him we're exulting. We're sick to death of Fay Wray and her screaming face at that point. We miss him terribly. I mean, somehow they've insinuated something very touching and moving about that animal. Isn't that so?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what I remember as a child. It scared me, but I loved him. I loved him. I also had the feeling that if he loved me like he loved her, he would take care of me for my whole life long, and I too could live at the top of the Empire State Building.
Both Where the Wild Things Are and your new book start at home in a very familiar setting. Some kind of transformation happens or change, and there's this journey into strange places, maybe scary, maybe you're more in control, but it ends back safely at home again, and it reminds me in that sense of fairy tales in which it concludes either back at home or back in a safe place again. Mm-hmm. Is that intentional on your part?
Well, I suppose so, because the form of the fairy tale is something I admire enormously. It's because I want to believe that everything will be all right. I mean, as a human being, I must believe everything will be all right. And these trips these kids take are more psycho trips than they are literal trips. They are journeying into places where it's tricky to be. Maybe a little scary, maybe exciting, maybe funny. But it's so much better to come home from those places, to find yourself in your own bed with the satisfaction of knowing you've accomplished something, that you have done something. That's the kind of trip I'm most interested in, actually.
Oh, it seems to make the mundane more comfortable, too, because like your boring bedroom suddenly becomes this wonderful refuge after the trip.
But I would say that the bedroom for a child is never boring or mundane. It's impossible. We don't know those words or those feelings until post-school days. I suspect, I would think that a child's bedroom is an ever-changing place all the time. Mine was as a child. I would no more have imagined my bedroom as boring as, couldn't possibly. Child has a vivid, healthy, ever-changing intellectual and spiritual life going. They're growing up. And it's catching any moment of that growing up that's exciting. It's really exciting because that's us. That's sort of what we should be doing all the time, not just when we're children.
You have a real astonishing collection of Mickey Mouse items, and I understand you were born in the same year that he was created?
Yeah, I am 6 months older than Mickey, actually, although I look considerably older than him, too. He's kept up his looks wonderfully.
What do you think of him looking back now as a visual character and as the personality that he was given and that, you know, changed through the decades?
Well, he's fabulous. He's one of the great graphic images America has created with Nemo and some other few cartoon characters. Mickey is just one of the most superb abstracted shapes with a personality. But my love for Mickey is very, very defined. I mean, somewhere between the year of his birth to about 10 years later do I count him as a beautiful objet. After that, I really feel he sort of sold out. He became sort of suburban and paunchy, and shape began to go downhill, and he was sort of making money and being extra nice, and I lost all interest with him somewhere in Fantasia. From Fantasia on, Sorcerer's Apprentice was his last great, you know, appearance. And then after that, I think as a character, as a personality, and even as a graphic image, he lost all his interest for me.
So you must be really glad now that you've held on to...
I didn't hold on.
You didn't?
No,
oh,
no. These were collected. I can't claim maybe one or two things in the Rosenbach exhibition are things that I actually had as a child. But all those things were recaptured. I collected them back. I'd seen them and had a lot of them as a child, but of course they were lost or broken. But I spent a lot of the 50s and early 60s before Mickey became a collector's item and something to invest in and was just fun to collect in little crazy stores in New York City. I found these wonderful toys and sort of regrouped my childhood and put them all around me. I can't get enough of him. I cannot get enough of him. I must say that includes Minnie too. I am not a male chauvinist pig. I mean, she has just as much the glorious face and figure that Mickey does, and they belong to each other.
What about Donald and Pluto?
Donald and Pluto, yes, but less so. They came later. No, Pluto not. Pluto was right along with Mickey, and being an avid dog lover, too, I have lots of Pluto. But I feel I love Donald, I admire Donald, but it's not with the same passion and obsession.
Did you ever consider creating a character that you could take through your different books?
No. Never would want to do that. I think that's a formula, or it could be a formula, and you would run the risk of going stale. And I think you could do the same by changing the child because you can express the same feelings via the form of another child. And then it's always fresh. It's always fresh. The danger of the same child is you could sink into a kind of lazy sloth and just get too formula with him or her.
So you never wanted to have your own Mickey Mouse type creation?
No, I never did. Mickey was great in this world. I didn't need a duplicate.
I have a feeling that I grew up with Mickey Mouse in the 1950s. I have a feeling for the kids growing up now, they're growing up with Star Wars characters, R2-D2 mm-hmm. and the crew. And certainly the images are being marketed as in as many varied ways on as many different products as the Mickey Mouse imagery mm-hmm. is. But it doesn't... I don't relate to it in the same way because I'm not a kid.
Yeah, you know? Nor do I because I'm not a kid. And I can't even imagine that they could have that powerful effect. And yet I know I'm wrong because I have friends with children who have every one of those characters. I see nothing in them. But then perhaps I shouldn't at this point in my life. However, show me a Mickey, vintage Mickey, and I'll go bananas right in front of your eyes. So I still think it has something to do with graphic beauty. I think there was something to the Mickey look that was so special that I defy any one of these things, you're the Star Wars toys or anything, having as superb a graphic entity as the Mickey Mouse toy.
Do you ever feel like in order to reach children sometimes that you have to tie in with space imagery and technology?
No, I don't. But see, we go back. I don't try to tie in with children.
Right.
See, I'm going to catch you every time you do that to me. I do not try to tie in with children. I'm just busy tying into myself before I kick this mortal coil. I mean, I'm just busy being an artist exploring me. I'm not concerned with children.
I'm going to backtrack a minute and get back to what we were talking about before about scary images. I had told you a little bit about this off the air, and I just want to pick up on it. I was bringing a book recently for a child who lives in the suburbs, and brought a book that didn't strike me as being very spooky, but it had unusual imagery in it. And the parents felt that this would really be a frightening book for the kids. And since the kids are pretty sheltered there in the suburbs, I thought, well, who am I to say? Maybe it will really shake them up. Do you think that suburban kids and city kids are tuned into different imagery?
No, I don't. No, I think kids are kids wherever they are. I mean, maybe kids in the country are more sheltered, but it's only a superficial surface sheltering. A parent has every right to interfere and edit what his child reads. And that's a simple truth. And maybe they know their child best. But I would say the other side to the story is that most parents identify or project their own anxieties onto what they're looking at and then pretend, even to themselves, that it's their child they're worried about. They will look at a book and shudder because it frightens them or upsets them, and they say, I'll never give this to little Sarah or little Tom because it's going to keep them up all night. But they haven't even tested it, haven't even allowed that their child doesn't feel as they do. I mean, it's a kind of egocentric attitude. They project onto the thing and say, it's me, and then they say, it's the child. It's not right. I don't believe in that kind of censorship. However, as I say, parents have the ultimate right, don't they?
Speaking of censorship, when your book In the Night Kitchen came out, one of the little boys had a visible penis.
Yeah, the only little boy had a visible penis, right.
Some libraries drew diapers over it to cover it up. Yeah. That must have infuriated you.
Yes, it infuriated me, put it mildly. I mean, that in such a time as our own, we still are as puritanical. True, it was only a small number, but it was enough to have caused a scandal over the book and to have enraged me because it was a serious work, and here all they talked about were peckers. I mean, it did reduce the book in a mortifying way to one object, which was the least interesting or important. Didn't affect the kids that way. Kids just went through the book, unless, of course, they had a copy where it was colored over. Then you hold the book up to the light, and then you see what it is, and then it gets dirty, right? So, of course, what they accomplished exactly what they set out to prevent, which is to attract the child's attention to this particular aspect, which to a child, hopefully, is a pleasurable aspect. I mean, there could be nothing more glorious than your own body until you're taught otherwise. And we are taught otherwise, eventually. So the book is just about a celebration, about being a child and having your body and having your soul and enjoying yourself and not knowing, or certainly not assuming, that anything is wrong with what God gave us.
Do you have any rights as the artist when libraries start redoing your book?
Well, you can't stop it. And as I say, it wasn't a major event, but I did write a letter, and it was signed by many of my colleagues, including E.B. White, saying this was an act of censorship, and it should be forbidden in the United States of America. It's one thing if you don't want the book in your library, that's your choice. Or if you don't want your child to read it, that's your right. But you do not mutilate a book. There were countries in the past that did that, and surely we have not forgotten those moments. Very upsetting.
Of your books, do you have favorites?
Higgledy Piggledy Pop. And Outside Over There. And I don't say Outside Over There because it's the last one. It's because I love it with all my heart, and I know how hard it was to do. And I feel that way about Higgledy because it was about Jenny, a beloved dog. And perhaps it's the one book I wrote that is funny. I mean, I laugh even now when I read it because it's so true to her. And I shouldn't be giving myself a puff here, but you asked the question. Yeah.
You know, it's a funny thing, looking at Outside Over There, there was something very familiar to me about the imagery. And what I mean by that is that, I don't know what I mean by that, but I felt just kind of like tied in with something that I can't really put my finger on it, so I don't know.
it's interesting.
I just can't explain it.
It's okay. But, your incoherence is flattering because since the book has come out, it's very recent. It's a new book, as you know. Many people have said something like what you've just said. Like it reminds them of something. They feel something. They feel embarrassed because they don't know how to express it. Well, that's lovely. It's obviously a subliminal something which is occurring, which is hooking up to something. And that's all that's intended. I mean, really, it isn't so interesting to me to analyze the book and break it into fragments and say eggshells mean this and soil means that and little girls in the air mean this. That's interesting too, but on a much more superficial, dry level. If a book attracts and pulls, well, it's what hopefully a painting does or a piece of music. You don't stop and examine. You're just happy, hopefully. That's what a work of art should do. So thank you.
Oh, yeah. It was It really meant to be a compliment, too, though. I wish I could explain it better. But it's just such really beautiful imagery. And well, you're living on a farm in Connecticut now?
Well, it's not really a farm, but it once was a working farm. It once was a working farm, but that was like 50 years ago.
Because it kind of interested me, the like 18th, where did...
It's early
19th century, yes. Pastoral imagery, and mm-hmm. also, you know, knowing that you're someone who grew up in Brooklyn.
Yeah. Well, it was the first major book I did living in the country, and there was no more doing a book with a child, an urban child. It had to be a kid from the country, since this was my adopted land. Ida, had to live in the country. There's just no question about it. And why early 19th century? That was homage to Grimm, because the story came from the goblins, and homage to Mozart, because he is my household god. And I was also then beginning to work on sets and costumes for the Magic Flute in Houston, and was deeply, deeply involved with Mozart, whose work I've always admired beyond all artists' work, and the Magic Flute perhaps beyond all works of art, conceivably. So the two melded together. There was just no pulling them apart. I mean, my book had to become part of his scene. I wanted to do and take from him as much as possible. I wanted to grasp and steal everything from Mozart that I could put in my pocket and go away with. And that's just what I did, to make myself happy, that's all. I even put him in the book.
Yeah, I noticed. That was very funny. You know, one of the things I was wondering about is if what you were thinking of when you drew the goblins, which I found to be very... very spooky little creatures, because you can't, they're small, gray, they're wearing like gray hooded.
Gray lavender.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. But there's no heads inside.
Well, they're dark spaces.
Dark spaces.
Yeah, but for a logical reason, were I to give my stroke away, which is that they're infants, there'll be nothing to the surprise page when they're revealed as, in fact, babies, just like Ida's sister. That's the only reason why there are dark spaces. But also, perhaps not, that's not the entire truth, because by seeing them as hooded, shrouded figures, I am, in fact, suggesting something ominous and strange going on, which,
kind of like,
were you to see them, would not be so ominous and strange.
Maybe that leads us back to the invisible man.
In a way, it's an interesting point, as a matter of fact, which no one has suggested, and I had not thought of at all. But he did come up in this conversation, didn't he? And I believe in things like that happening. Yeah, that's very possible. He is a hint at the invisible man, or they are. There are no faces.
Who are some of the painters that have most inspired you, or
in this
you
book,
felt close to?
In this book?
No, in all of your work.
Well, oh, there's lots of them. German painters, really, specifically... In this, but let's talk about this particular book, because they're uppermost in my mind at the moment.
Good.
And it's early 19th century painters. There's an exhibition right now at the Met in New York of these guys. They're very, not to painters little known, but to the public little known. Names like Caspar David Friedrich and Philipp Otto Runge, all part of the very earliest romantic movement in history, in German history. Goethe is an old man. Classicism is ending, and the new romantic period is coming in because Napoleon has decimated the world, and these guys are holding on to something. It's when the Grimm tales were collected, as a matter of fact. It's 10 years after Mozart's death. It's an extremely interesting time in painting history and literature. So these guys, Runge and Friedrich, were two very strong influences on this book, and I would like to disclaim an influence that a lot of the reviews assume, which is El Greco. I've read a number of articles on my book where it was absolutely presumed, I cannot imagine why, that I was influenced by El Greco. I would like to take the moment to say no, and that there ain't nothing between me and El Greco, and never was, sad to say, but I don't feel him at all, so I don't want him in my book, and I disclaim him.
What about William Blake?
Oh, yes, I'll claim him all I can. but he's the same period, just... is a peculiar time, because Blake was doing these mystical, poetic visions of childhood and babies and Runge was doing it in Germany. And of course, neither of them knew of each other. And yet how curious they were doing it at the same and only time in history this was happening. I love Blake. I adore Blake for obvious reasons. He's poet-illustrator. I've taken so much from him, I don't know where to begin. I mean to tell you.
You know, the new book, the colors that you use in the illustration are in the illustrations are very muted pastels.
Mm-hmm. Except it's gouache and tempera that I've painted with. Yes, but the palette is very muted.
And it's been my experience a few times in the recent past when I've shot for children's books that a lot of them are like bright orange, lime green, really loud colors. Is there... What do you think about when choosing your palette? And again, I mean, I know that this isn't like, hey, what's going to appeal to the kids?
Right, okay. But I think it's up for grabs, is whatever the artist chooses. I mean, I've changed my palette a lot, and I've had vibrant colors at one point in my life, never as vibrant as what you're describing. But I would say that was entirely up to the artist and dependent entirely on the finished product. Is it beautiful? I don't care if it's jazzy colors. Is it beautiful? Does it work as a book? That's the primary question, not the color scheme.
Have you worked through periods where illustration has come in and out of favor as far as, you know, being seen as an important art?
Yes. Oh, it's never been seen as an important art, okay? It's become an important art in America because it is so profitable in terms of children's books. And so you have a proliferation of illustrated books because there is almost no other place to illustrate. When I was growing up in New York, an illustrator could do illustrations for Esquire magazine, which was a great coup, or any of the commercial magazines. And illustration in books for children was just one other form of getting your work printed. But then the magazines began collapsing. The magazines began fading and changing, and illustration began ending as an art form in magazines. And more, books for children turned out to be the only place that you could get illustration published. There are lots of artists who would never originally turn on to the idea coming to it because there were no other routes to take to publish their work. And that was the boom. That was the boom in publishing when they all came flocking in. Both good and bad occurred from that. But in any form, there is always only a small margin of terrific work and then lots of work, period.
You know the old insult, he's not really a painter, he's an illustrator?
Yeah, I grew up with that. I grew up with that, you know, if you didn't cut your ear off or go bananas and blow your brains out at the age of 30, you were a failure. And if you lived to 50, you were certainly a failure. We all grew up with that. Illustrators were commercial hacks, whores of Babylon, sold-out people. The painters were the terribly refined, intellectual effete types who didn't eat food and didn't smoke cigarettes and didn't have sex and died young. Dreary way of life, it seems to me. But in fact, I'm being mean in describing it this way because I did suffer from that comparison, that illustrators were commercial people. And what a joy it was, and he always has given me joy, is Van Gogh. Van Gogh is the least prejudicial artist that ever lived on the face of the earth. And when you read Van Gogh's letters to his brother Theo, and he carries on about his enthusiasms for the illustrated magazines in England. He mentions lots of famous children's illustrators like Randolph Caldecott and Beatrix Potter, and so the people he would find cut out and then would become models for his paintings, and he never, never defined painting as being better than illustrating or vice versa. Picture-making was picture-making to him. I mean, it was just what he did for a living and what turned his soul on. And that's the way it ought to be, of course. There is no division. We make these arbitrary divisions, and they're very painful for young people.
You know, I'm thinking that the place for adults in the past couple of decades with a lot of illustration is science fiction magazines, but I guess that's not really the type of illustration that's ever appealed to you.
No, not to me personally. But, I mean, there's all forms of illustration. I mean, illustration in books is a very particular form. Illustration in magazines is another particular form, and sometimes one artist is not suitable to do the other. I am not a good magazine illustrator, never was. And when I did work for magazines when I was younger, because I had to earn money, it is my least interesting work and work that I no longer look at. I didn't do it well. You have to have another attitude. You have to have a kind of punchier attitude. You have to come on strong. I don't come on that way. I need lots of room to breathe and stretch And the book form then became the best form for me. It allowed me the most room, 40 pages, to pull myself up.
How'd you like doing animation?
I loved doing the film I did on Rosie. The form of animation is extremely arduous, and I think I would never go back to it. Too expensive, and you can't go back and repair anything. I mean, if you forget her mouth in two, in two cells, it costs, I don't know how many thousands of dollars to go back and fix. It's not a form that would ever turn me on.
Don't you have a lot of people working with you when you're doing something?
Yes,
like
you do.
I was thinking of the Disney Studios, for instance, as being like a factory.
Yes, but it's never that much of a factory because we're working on a little budget if you're making a special. And there are very few people. It's tons of pictures to draw. It is fun, but it takes a very long time, and the frustrations are more than the pleasures, so far as I'm concerned.
Now you've been doing costume and set design also for operas.
And Rosie has been turned into an off-Broadway show. She's been running 7 months, and I much rather and prefer working with alive children, changing their lines, doing sets and costumes for them, to working with animation, to working with cells. It's much better to work with people, put it mildly.
When you're doing the costume set design, do you draw illustrations and then other people do the sewing and construction?
Yeah, they do, but then I'm in on the construction and sewing. You do your costume drawings, but then you go to the costume house and you help pick fabrics and you work with an assistant and you work with specialty sewers or builders of forms or whatever. Like in the Vixen, there were tons of insects and birds, costumes for children. Well, you have to be in on the construction. I mean, it's no use just leaving your drawing there and hoping it's going to turn out right any more than it is leaving a book at the printer and hoping it'll turn out right. You've got to stay there and see that it does turn out right. But the costume making on the operas was immensely enjoyable because it's a novelty. I've never done it before. Made some dramatic mistakes.
Like what?
Oh, well, I'm not going to tell. But they're up there on the stage, and lots of things turn out much more beautifully than I expected.
You have to draw differently knowing that it's going to be realized?
Yeah, you have to draw differently knowing that someone's going to have to wear it. I mean, you can't just draw for the fun of it if somebody's going to stand up there and faint because there's nothing to breathe through. So you have to learn that you're simply not doing this for your own pleasure anymore. Well, yes, you are, of course, but you're also doing it for someone else's comfort. Something to have a prima donna come storming in on you and say, how the hell am I going to wear this when you've not allowed for me to hear anything, to see the conductor, and then use some choice four-letter words, okay? You go back to the drawing board, give her ears and eyes and breathing apparatus, and she's right. She's got to come out, sing, jump, roll, dance, do everything, and be good at the same time. And what she's saying, come on, help me. So you learn it's a tremendous collaborative effort, much more than anything I've ever done in my life. And for that reason, perhaps better than anything I've done in my life.
I'm talking with Maury Sendak, if you're just joining us. Some of your books have been, I guess most of your books have been translated into all kinds of languages, including Icelandic and Korean. Do you get to see the translations?
Yes, I do. I look solemn, like I know what I'm reading, but of course I don't. I just hope it's all right. Those languages I can't speak, I do check out the translations, and occasionally the languages I do not speak but have friends who do, I ask them to check out the translations. I really do as much as I can for those books in the hopes that they are printed well. Most of the time they are. They're taken very seriously abroad, and I have no complaints to make. Occasionally, a publisher will go half-cock and do it his or her way, and that's the end of that publisher. I will then withdraw rights from them forever because there are certain ground rules you have to follow. If the American edition is something I truly admire, then I want to get it to look that way abroad with compromises. Sometimes they can't afford. Usually they can't afford what we can do here. But you want to be in on those compromises. You want to make them. You don't want to let them make them.
Do you think that the stories and illustrations apply as well in faraway places as they do here?
Of course. When one of the best moments of my life was seeing Wild Things as an opera in Brussels, and seemingly 9 million Belgian school children pouring into the auditorium, gabbling in French and Flemish, holding their Flemish-French version of Wild Things under their arms. And then when the house lights dim and this great Wild Things face appears on stage as the curtain drop and you hear this great sigh emanate from the kids, and then they hold up their books like at a Bund meeting or something and start screaming, Max, 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 Max. Well, what are you going to feel but terrific?
Really?
Yeah, it was wonderful. Just wonderful. I mean, they know what Max is. I mean, every kid has something of him, I think. Doesn't have to be an American kid.
You're living in the country now, and you mm-hmm. said that that really influenced the illustrations in your new book, and that it had to be set in the country. Is that going to be that way for other projects?
I think so. I think so. I love the country. I love the country. There are sunsets now, which I call Ida sets, because I copy the color for her dress and gown. And the country has become dearer to me because of that book, because I had to look so hard to take from everything around me that everything is now more familiar, and the book has made life easier for me there. It helped me adapt to living in a different environment, so that now I wouldn't live anywhere else in the world if I have any choice.
Does that usually, when you're drawing something, change the way you relate to it?
Yeah.
Even if it's your dog?
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. That's the beauty of being an artist. I think it's just one of the luckiest things in the world to be an artist, is that you can change things around you by what you do. It helps you as a person immensely.
How has it changed, like, your dog, for instance? Like, your dog's in the
Well, I've worked out so many problems with my dogs via my books.
Seriously?
I'm very serious. I did a book called Some Swell Pup, where I revealed myself. I bared my soul about how terribly I treated my dogs because I didn't know better. So I did this book, you know, a big confessional about how not to treat your dogs. Well, I learned a lot from doing that book. I mean, I had to recapitulate. I had to get back to my dogs. I had to find a way of dealing with them that wasn't stupid parent with child. I was no better than anybody else. You know, I flew off the handle. I was tormented. My dogs were dumber than the next door neighbor's dogs. All that shtick that I'm so contemptuous of, there I was doing it. Well, it's hard to find you are just like everybody else when it comes to children and dogs. So when it came time to do a portrait of my dog in Higgledy was a very different thing, and to do a portrait of my dog on outside over there, the German Shepherd who really should be taking care of things and isn't an outside over there, is my little ironic portrait of my dear dog who, when there's a noise in the house and he's lying atop my bed, looks at me and says more or less, "Hey, Maurice, you want to go down and see what's happened?" He doesn't go down.
Do you feel like as an adult also that you've ever done things that you swore you wouldn't when you were a child interacting
with Of course. I mean, one makes an endless fool of oneself as one grows up and contradicts every goal or everything you committed that you would not do. Why? Because you're a person. You have to do it to some extent.
Do you ever get any grief from people who see your work as children's books and say, well, he doesn't have any kids, therefore he doesn't really understand what happens
sure.
in a child's mind?
I hear it all the time, but it doesn't give me grief anymore.
Good. So you'll continue to live in the country? And
I shall. As long as I can, I shall live in the country. And come into New York City, and New York City is a city I adore. Come to Philadelphia, where my spiritual home is, because Rosenbach is here and has all my work. In fact, I can go to Europe, and I'm welcome there because of my books. So I'm pretty lucky, I think.
Yeah. Did you gave a lot of your papers to the Rosenbach?
Well, I gave almost, I gave everything, as a matter of fact.
What do you think about before deciding who to give it to?
Well, I give it to a place where it's alive. You don't give it to a university where they merely store it away forever. I'm not interested in storage. That's cemetery work. What happens at the Rosenbach is that the entire museum is alive with interested and interesting people and an incredible collection. There's Marianne Moore and Herman Melville and the Tenniel drawings to Alice, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. And what happens, and why I like my work being there, is people come to the Rosenbach and they can see the work. They can examine the work. The work will be taken out by eager, interested people who supervise the museum so that your work is constantly shown. In fact, it's alive for students and interested people. It isn't stored. Who cares about storing stuff? I could have done that in my basement. What happens with the Rosenbach is they take care of your work, and it's permanently alive.
You can get any of it if you need it.
You can get any of it. I can get any of it if I want it. And also there is a constant motion, small exhibition, exhibitions all over the country. People are always asking. The Rosenbach will then arrange for this exhibition. Then they have their own exhibitions.
Not only does it include some of Maurice Sendak's drawings, like working drawings and things that became posters, paintings, illustrations, but it also has a lot of the toys that he's collected over the years, a lot of the Mickey Mouse items that he's collected over the years, including that great Mickey Mouse and Pygmy Land book.
And the first drawing I have that I drew in a copy of Alice in Wonderland.
Oh, the doodle.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you what it feels like to see, like, you know, how old were you then?
I was about seven. And it's a terrible drawing. That's the incredible thing, is that I showed no talent as a child. I mean, it's a real rotten drawing. I mean, it's interesting in terms of my history and the fact that I'm so proud of books and I insist on taking care of books. And here I wrote all over a book, but curiously, it shows no talent.
Well, I just think it's really bizarre to think that, you know, your 7-year-old doodle is now on display.
Yeah, yeah. It would have thrilled my mother and father.
Do you remember doing it?
Of course, I remember doing it. I remember when that book had a jacket. I remember when I borrowed it. I remember the thrill of borrowing it. I remember the incredible thrill of being able to read most of it myself with minimal help from my sister and not wanting to give it back, which is why that book is now in the Rosenbach. I did not give it back. I mean, I wrote that apologetic letter in the fly leaf of the book explaining why I wasn't giving it back and how I lost the jacket and all that stuff, but I never gave it back, did I? There it is.
Since some of your imagery really strikes me as being dream imagery, I wonder if you have very detailed dreams that you remember and perhaps work from.
I have very detailed dreams like you do, but I don't work from them. Nope. I just remember them and moon over them for a while until I forget them. I'm not conscious of working from them. I really am not.
Do you like to think about your dreams? I mean, do you take them seriously?
I take them. Well, I was in therapy for a long time, and that's your homework. And when you're in therapy, you dream, you know, like doing your Regents exam. Every night you come up with a fully detailed dream. I find once out of therapy, I have more trouble recalling them. I mean, they slide away from me much more easily now, and probably because I have no one to tell them to, and there's no purpose to follow through or any course to take with them. So they're less vitally a part of my life at this point. But I love having the dreams. I enjoy recollecting them very much, yeah.
A lot of people have just adored your books since the early 1950s. And what kind of feedback have you gotten that's been most valuable to you about what it is in your work that is so one that your readers find wonderful?
I think in a curious way you've expressed it yourself during this program. I do. I'm very lucky. I get letters from children. I know a whole generation now, like your age, and people with children who are now starting another generation. But if it were to be summed up, it were not to be a verbal pleasure. It would be a nonverbal pleasure, and that gives me a lot of pleasure, because that's where the word comes from, some nonverbal place, and that's what you're reacting to.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us today.
I've really enjoyed it,
and I've enjoyed meeting you. Thanks.
Thank you.
And thanks
Same
for your
here.
Books. You know, thanks for having done them. I've been talking with Maury Sendak, and he's in Philadelphia today. There's the show opening at the Rosenbach Museum at 2010 Delancey Street. And there's also a new book, which is called Outside Over There, which has just been published. It's got beautiful, beautiful illustrations in it. It's a really wonderful story, and it's just been published by Harper & Row.